presenters on up here, and we've got a couple different generations, and all working at it from different angles. Very good. I'm going to try to keep up with Dr. Schockett's history, but I don't have his World War II experience. Those of you afterwards, if you want to hear some great history, come on up and talk with Dr. Schockett about his care that he gave in England and his training in England. But enough about that. My name's Dr. Dan Kasperczak, and I'm going to try to speed things up a little bit so we may have a little questions here at the end. As Dr. Schockett went on over, this country has a long history of care for people that have borne the battle. The interesting thing here about the Pilgrims, when they were fighting the Pequot Indians, they had a promise to people in their colony something. So they made a law, one of the first laws ever in the colony, to say anyone who got injured fighting the Indians in the war, that the colony would support them. Not a pension, but support. So they'd bring them some porridge, they'd cut their firewood during the winter, they would take care of them. And that pretty much stayed the same until we fought a Revolutionary War, where people were a little bit more jaded and money was a more common means of doing business. So pensions were invented at that particular time, where we promised people that we would give them a certain amount of money if they were injured, but only to the veteran themselves. This stayed pretty much the same thing until Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, where the government not only promised to take care of the war wounded, but also of their widows and their orphans. So we can see an advancement. In 1930, the modern VA was formed, consolidated all the different services, as Dr. Schockett had gone on over there. But really, the big history and transformation in the VA here happened in 1995. We received a new director, Dr. Ken Kaiser. And he must have cut some deals with the people in Congress or had pictures of somebody, because he was able to get laws changed in this country. As Dr. Schockett had gone over here, we were pretty much an inpatient-driven organization until then. The laws were changed for us to go from taking care of the service-connected, that would be the people that were injured while in the service, as well as the homeless and the indigent. They were now able to take care of anyone that was had served their country. And so this allowed us to move from basically an inpatient facility into an outpatient-driven thing. At that time, there was 179 medical centers. We're down now to 171 through consolidation and reorganization. We have 350 outpatient clinics, 126 nursing homes, 35 domiciliaries, and we have a number of veteran centers and other healthcare local initiatives that get us up well over 800 community-based centers, which are all new since Dr. Kaiser was in. So I talk about VA quality. And I call it BK and AK before Kaiser. We were basically just taking care of service-connected people, almost all exclusively as inpatients. There was no outpatient care except for one post-hospital visit that patients were allowed to receive. There was no creature comforts. My first VA I worked in was up in Tennessee. It was basically a large Quonset hut. It's 42-bed wards. There's no curtains in between everyone. It was just one long thing. If somebody spit at the end, somebody else would collect it on the other end. We had no TVs except one per smoking room. So I don't know why people even smoked in those days, because all you had to do was buy cigarettes. You just walked into the smoking room and it was, you couldn't see from one end to the other. There was a TV in there. The screen was always yellow from all the nicotine that was on the walls and on the screen. In those days, we had a cart that came by in the ward, and it sold discounted cigarettes and discounted candy to the patients that were in the ward. Care was free pretty much back then, because you had to qualify in order to get into the VA system. Length of stay was extraordinarily long compared to the community at that time. Average length of stay in local hospitals was about 7 to 8 days. The VA hospital back in the 60s to really 1995, average about 24 days. The magic number was to get to 30, because if you were a non-service connected veteran and you were in the hospital for 30 days, you were eligible for everything. So all the veterans that came in that had no teeth, or they just had little nubs that we would see along the way, that needed dental care, that needed prosthetics, that needed crutches, that needed anything in order to have their life good. And when you got them to 30 days, they could get everything. So they were always stalling or begging at that weight. And as Dr. Schockett alluded to, we were perceived in the VA as having a lower quality of care than in the community or anywhere else. I guess bad jokes even were on out there. AK, after Kaiser, we took all the staff that used to take care of patients on the inpatient side. We mobilized them to staff our new outpatient clinics, which became community-based. And we went from the hospital I'm at now, the Bay Pines Hospital. We had 1,100 beds is what we used to boast. And everyone had to drive within a 350-mile range to receive their health care at our medical center. Now we have 16 community-based outpatient clinics, as well as a variety of other community centers. There was a 300% increase in the amount of veterans served during this process. We're now a data-driven culture with patient-centered care. Patient satisfaction is huge in the VA. We survey our patients so much that they almost complain that we're surveying so much. It's very important. Every time that they say that there's something they don't like, it gets ranked, and everything that's in our bottom 3 out of 10 things, we have to come up with action plans in order to resolve those things. So data and patient satisfaction is huge. In the past, it was lower priority, I would call it. We're now perceived not only in this country as having a high quality product, but also around the world. Our electronic medical record, some of our services, which I'm going to go over here, are really world class. I'm also going to give a little history about medical education in this community. About 100 years ago, Abraham Flexner wrote a seminal article to the Carnegie Foundation about teaching in this country. Medical education at that time was a hodgepodge of people having medical schools in their backyard. And Flexner, his recommendations were that all medical education occur at universities because they had the resources, they had laboratories, they had endowments, they had a proven history of teaching. And after that, pretty much all medical schools became associated with university campus settings, with most of those having on-campus hospitals that became the model and really still remains the standard at this particular time. He also was the proposer of the 2 years of didactic teaching followed by 2 years of clinical teaching, which in most cases has not changed in that 100 years. But there are new medical schools that are coming on board. Since 2007, there's 11 brand new or proposed medical schools around this country. An example of the old here, University of Chicago, world-class hospital, but it doesn't look any different than it did back in 1920. It has the same buildings, the same hospital, the same clinics. It's got a gigantic endowment, has about the same number of students that have they expanded up in the Great Expansion in the 60s, but really not much different. A new university, medical school is coming on board now, Hofstra University, just is the latest one coming on board just this year. Florida International University, School of Medicine in Miami, UCF College of Medicine in Orlando, just came on within the last year. So as part of the new thing, instead of having hospitals, university hospitals built on the property, they now have off-site campuses. These are new developments. Instead of having live patients, simulation models are now creeping their way into most of the universities. The states have now taken over the vast majority of the funding for these medical schools, and with decreasing federal monies that are available. And as Dr. Schockett alluded to, and I'm going to touch base a little bit more on here, is the burgeoning, gigantic student debt problem, which also is problematic as we move forward into the 21st century teaching of our students. Dr. Kirch's presidential speech in 2007, he challenged everyone to change our culture. He said we needed to move from having rewards for individual achievements to achievements for teams. And anyone in here who's been involved with any medicine or any, you know, advances, we know that the individual achievements really should supersede to teams. I looked at all the presentations, not only here, but in other areas, and when people are citing things, they don't just say this was a paper by Cook, this wasn't a presentation by Pasteur, this wasn't by other famous people. There's teams that have to be put together in order to have research, teams that have to go for clinical things. Marcus Welby is struggling on out there, although we do have a number of solo practitioners on out there, but unfortunately we have a lot of solo mentalities out there which have not caught up. And as we move forward into the 21st century of teaching, some of the things I want to lay out here will show that the VA is a leader in team building and breaking down these, I'm going to say, old soloist types of mentalities. So comparing the 20th century physician to the 21st century here, the 21, they focused on the individual scholarly work. They were autonomous. They were cooperative to get things done, but everything was going back to them. It was individual achievement, and everything was physician-centered. As we moved into the 21st century here, we have to have interdisciplinary research team. We have to be collaborative. We have people working in Canada with people that are working in Thailand that are here in Washington, D.C. in order to do their research and collaborate. Nobody just writes a paper by themselves. They have to have a scientist that's going to be in the laboratory collaborating with their lab techs that are collaborating with the clinicians along the way. Coordination of care is really where things are being centered on at this time. Teamwork. What is a team? Putting all of us into a room together and somebody goes dominus, dominus, you're all a team now, will that work? No. Believe me, all of you, I can tell you, you've all been on teams before. Has anyone ever been on a team that's not worked very well? Just raise your hand. I've been on a bunch of them along the way. So teamwork does not just happen. So as we have this premise that we need to go forward with teams, how many of you have received training on how to become a team member, on how to be good team players and how to facilitate teams? So we got a smattering of hands on up here. Excellent. So some of the common traits really is a commitment to a mission or to a goal. I'm getting out of my time, so I'm really going to speed on up here. You have to have trust in the people and you have to have some training. Truckman has your four stages: forming, storming, norming, and performing. The storming is the place where people break down. The VA has committed a significant amount of time and energy to that. Our training for Teamworks, we have programs from IHA programs, the TEACH program, CARE, Motivational Interviewing, Covey 7 Steps. All these are mandatory trainings for our staffs, not just our physician staffs, but staff up and down that will be forming our particular teams. Our PAC teams have daily huddles where we meet. Information is sought. People have responsibilities. We have weekly reviews. People have defined roles. It's just not the physician leader taking care of everything. We different staff people have their roles. Some of the things that we have already had in place before our PAC model, which I'll go into here real quickly, we've had a fully formed electronic medical record since 1996 that has evolved into a world-class medical record. We can order our medicines, we can order our consults. I can see patients' charts at any VA hospital in the country. I can get their military records from wherever they were discharged from. I can see their medicines, I can see their consults, I can see their successes and their failures. We've been fully integrated with our mental health as a primary care measure. Every facility has a mental health provider with it, and we have integrated pharmacists with all of our primary care teams. As we've implemented our primary care PACT model, we've now included social workers, LPNs, RN care managers, and clerks into these teams, which meet and take a look at the patients in their panels, which we were assigned to manage. We move from individual care to teamwork. We're being coached. We're a data-driven society, so we have data on everyone. We not only benchmark in our own facility, but we benchmark with other VAs across the country. We also benchmark with the local community. We have total quality improvement. Other professions coming into our model is dentistry. The VA has a dentistry primary care residency program. The goal is that every time that they see somebody who's on Coumadin, they don't have to put in a consult and waste a week trying to get it answered along the way. So we're working on having oral physicians as opposed to dentists along the way. We already have an integrated primary care mental health program. We have obesity teams, and I'm going to get kicked off the stage here. So I'm going to go right. Some of the things that we have coming up in the future is we have an obese population that drinks too much, that drugs too much, that are losing their income and are indigent. The VA has a long history of dealing with them and a success record over the last 10 to 15 years of putting them into a priority. One of our thoughts going on with Dr. Shockett here is that the VA has the population, it has the infrastructure, and has a proven track record of success as we move forward into the 21st century for teaching. And we do have a lot of flexibility. We also have the possibility to go with our National Health Corps model, where because of the huge debt, an average of $158,000 debt, with 10% of the students with over $250,000 in debt that they cannot pay off, to give stipends maybe into the third and fourth year students to attract them into our facility to have a role model as we deal with primary care teaching communication skills so that they will take those with a debt that they would have to pay back in time. And studies have shown that the more time you spend in primary care and spend in some of our rural clinics, deal with our primary care issues, that the goal is to have them see that success, be nurtured, and go into primary care roles in some of our underserved areas. So I'm going to stop right there because I'm at my last slide. Thank you.
So maybe our first prototype project should be in L.A., and see what the collaboration can be with the VA out there. All right, any questions that people would like to pose to the panelists? We only have 15 minutes left, so we can get started right with the questions.
Uh-huh. Are there any affiliations in the works? And are there any medical school affiliations or developments in the works?
The affiliation is what we've been doing since the end of World War II.
Well, I think he means in terms of community outreach and actually pilot testing what you're talking about in terms of how the VA can be integrated. So Dr. Kasperzak is saying no, that hasn't really been done yet. Yeah.
Why aren't you doing doctor voter democracy in Virginia?
Yes, I think you should all talk to him if you have some thoughts about other places that it could be piloted, because the national offices are in D.C. I think you had your hand.
Is there a curriculum for training the leaders in your model, and is that curriculum available?
I'm going to repeat the question because I don't know if it's recording. Is there a curriculum for training leaders in the program?
Well, we don't have a set curriculum. We have set topic areas that we've gone over, but we don't have a set curriculum at this time. But I'd be happy to share with you sort of what we've put together so far if you want to know.
So I'm back there then.
Excellent question. The way we talk about it actually is two things. One, know the audience, as you're saying. I specifically highlighted health disparities, knowing this audience. The way I share two stories when we think of addressing hospitals. One, this is already happening. That first point we make, we give the examples of what's happening in the Mississippi Hospital Association and the Texas Hospital Association. In Mississippi in particular, they actually, outside of the Rx Democracy Coalition, started a voter registration process, not because of a commitment to public health or population health. And in fact, exactly to your point, they did it because they knew in the New World Order, post-healthcare law and trying to figure out how to position themselves as a public hospital system that's trying to stay afloat, they realized that they needed their constituents, meaning their staff and their patients, to have a voice. So we lead oftentimes not with the health disparities angle, to your point, or with the public health angle. We say this is good for your constituents, and your constituents include patients and staff. The second story that we tell to drive home that point is a story actually of what happened in 2008 with the VA. The VA administrator at the time had issued a directive in early 2008 stating that voter registration was not allowed on VA sites. That created a bit of a backlash, you may recall this, and I'd like to actually hear it. Please open it up to our experts here to comment on this. But in short, there was a vocal pushback organized by two secretaries of state, and one in Connecticut, one in Washington State, and a lot of veterans advocacy organizations, et cetera. The VA administrator had said what a lot of hospital administrators would say, and rightly so. This is too political, and this is going to interfere with patient care. Voter registration, right? It turns out that after some public pressure, and after the counter-argument was made that, you know, after defending the rights of Americans, why shouldn't we let our veterans exercise their own? When that pushback happened, the VA said, you're right, this makes sense. And to their extreme credit, and I think this happened with the speed that actually, again, represents the phrase that Dr. Schockett mentioned again and again, flexibility. The VA really, unlike a lot of other hospital systems, has demonstrated flexibility, and I can speak specifically to the voter registration story. So we share that story, and we share it for two reasons. One, if a hospital system as large as the VA realize that it does not interfere with patient care, nor is it too political to allow your patients to vote, then other hospitals can follow suit. Second, to your point, this is a strategic priority. You know, let your constituents have a voice because then your hospital can be heard, and particularly for a public hospital. And the third point is, and this is part of the reason I share the VA story, our veterans are leading the way, right? So let other public hospitals follow suit so that other Americans who have the opportunity to exercise their rights through the vote, or other Americans who don't necessarily have access to the vote, whether you're an ex-felon or for whatever restrictions, if you're undocumented, if you're a resident in the U.S., there are other opportunities for civic engagement. But let's start with a vote. Let's talk about how to get those who are not part of the system involved, because it's good for your bottom line.
Yes.
I have to apologize for not coming in sooner because I've enjoyed this last 45 minutes. But 27 years ago, I entered into the Houston Veterans Administration to begin my registered dietitian's internship. And actually, I'm sad to not know whether or not that internship still is there. But I'm pleased to see the opportunity for expanding the education within the VA. And when I entered the hospital, I believe there was one woman. And so I became very familiar with the Harris-Benedict equation for energy needs of men. But it didn't have to do a whole lot with the ladies, which I'm assuming would have been a different case. So I was glad to see the segue ending your talk with the obesity initiative, the adding to your dental activities, the idea of the nutrition and education and dietetics and engagement involving the registered dietitian in the educational plan and programming that you're planning to move forward and build.
Yes, we have a, I'm going to say a world-class obesity, because we have the obesity epidemic in the United States. So about 9 years ago, I was part of a group that put together a program. We call it the MOVE program, Managing Obese Veterans Everywhere. And even though the successes for total weight loss are mediocre, when you have people come into our program, the tremendous improvements in hemoglobin A1Cs for those obese diabetic patients, it's unbelievable. Those people that have cardiovascular, the LDL drop is tremendous. The overall quality of life indicators that the patients report is off the chart. And blood pressure control, significant. So even though some weight loss is marginal, those health benefits are dramatic in just a 6 to 12 week program. So we do have a huge amount of registered dietitians at all of our VAs now. We do have residency internship programs for our dietitians, and they are integral in our VA as we move forward with our team. Mental health, recreational therapy, and dietitians really are going to be a forefront as we tackle, you know, Syndrome X or whatever you want to call it into the future here.
And that's a really good example of putting together the various disciplines and what a difference, because especially in diabetes, I think so many people have no idea what a difference it would make if the weight came down. That you'd better, yeah.
I'd like to ask another question. How do you think the health reform law and VA hospital, I mean, you're promoting it as, you know, a national health service kind of alternative. And what are you thinking? How would that work?
You're talking about the Obama's legislation?
Yeah.
What I commented before was I was thunderstruck during those months prior to that voting that I did not see anywhere where the VA was suggested as the way in which to ease the American population into an across-the-board good health care scheme.
Well, as the law goes forward now, it's in the future. It's evolving, you know, 2012, 2014. How's that going to work?
If you give me 2 hours, I can do the whole job. There's nothing to it. The VA program works. And all it needs is to be modified to take in the total population. I would start with the uninsured. And that's the way to go. It's very simple for me. And I don't know what's going to happen.
I guess my question would be, are there any forces? I mean, the VA is a very powerful lobby, and I'm just curious, is there anything even being spoken of in those terms? I've heard nothing about this.
The only thing I've heard is veterans themselves cherish the uniqueness of the healthcare system they enjoy. And as a group, they are kind of reluctant to share that. So it's up to you lovely ladies to persuade them.
Yes.
One additional comment on that. The VA budget for VA healthcare is... this last year was $44 billion with a B, dollars. The
the total VA expenditures for the cemetery service, the VA benefits, compensation and pension was $100 billion with a B dollars. As we're in whatever, well, we're either getting out of the recession or we're going deeper, I'm not certain. But when you have that kind of a budget, then people are going to take a look at it seriously, especially as we're into the medical school and other schools expansion over this next 7 years. How are things going to be paid for? I think people are taking a look at an organization that I've tried to outlay there was looked at as bad quality, and people still think of it as bad quality when those 70% of the people trained through there, but it's not anymore. We're a world leader, and I think we could be leaned upon.
I'm affiliated with a veterans hospital in Iron Mountain, Michigan. Patients are very grateful for their care compared to the community. You brought up the budget. I'm just curious, on a per capita basis per year, how does the Veterans Administration cost comparison compared to the what we've got as a current outpatient or what is it, non-veterans healthcare system? In other words, how are the costs comparing for the Blue Cross Blue Shield patient compared to the veterans patient? Do you know that? Or?
Well, yeah, the truth is always in the details for money. In the last 10 years, there's been about a 50% increase in the total cost per patient in the VA. It varies depending on the categories. There's 8 categories of veterans. Each one of them costs a little bit different. It's all broken on out. So when you compare that cost to the average cost per patient in the United States, which has gone up over 10% per year, our 3% per year is less than the average cost rising up. But I do not know our average cost compared to the average cost of care in this country. Part of that is it's like
it's
apples and oranges.
$8,000, just in the Washington Post.
No, was it?
$7,000, close to $8,000
on average. We have what they would in the VA, what they call a Medicare heavy load. Where Dr. Shockett works, in his clinic they have 16,000 patients. The average age of the patient is 70 years of age. That's the average age. They go on up to 100 years of age. And so in that population, the average cost is somewhere in the $25,000 to $30,000 per year cost. So I would say that we're cheaper, but there may be some services that maybe were more expensive.
The vets that I'm working with tend to be sicker than the average population, and so you have to do a matching by an ICD-9 code and age and comorbidities and all that other stuff.
I don't think that's been, if it hasn't been done, I don't know it.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some research out there.
Really a fully patient-driven movement, so that with through training and support that our patient leaders really really lead the movement. Where we also hope to see it going is that there's reform at a policy level that improves access to quality care for patients in South Los Angeles, and that we hope that through participating in the Right to Health committees that those organizing opportunities actually improve individual health as well.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for your attention and your wonderful questions. Really appreciate it. And thanks to each of you. You did a great job.
Thank you.